with Len Vidopic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Len Vidopic Show here on today's News Talk TNT. In a short while, we'll be speaking to Neil Petrie, Army Intelligence Officer for 16 years and a Middle East expert. We'll be talking about what's going on in the Israeli-Gaza situation. We have to discuss that and hopefully a little bit about Ukraine and whether Neil thinks the $61 million, which the United States is going to send to Zelensky, who's the premier of Ukraine, is going to make much difference or not. Before that, we're going to be speaking to our political editor here at today's News Talk, TNT, Basil Valentine. And before that, let me just read some of the messages before we go to Basil. Neil Gardner says at some stage, most UK politicians will claim they always opposed the mass murder of Gaza civilians and never supported Netanyahu's regime. Yeah, I suspect you're probably right. Look, as you say, Neil, much of the world feels that already as against Israel's behaviour. Remember, being anti-Israel politics isn't the same as being anti-Semitic. It's a mistake a lot of people make, thinking the two things are the same. Madrid says, I eat lots of oysters. Well, you're going to hell then, according to the Bible, a certain part of it. Don't eat shellfish, it says. I tend to think the Bible is metaphorical. Others take it more literally. Pick and choose, says Massey. Yeah, I have met many people who do seem to pick and choose bits of the Bible like that. Odin Wild Hunt says, this Laura is an absolute delight. I totally agree. I thought she had a lovely manner. Mazzy says, love thy neighbor. Well, mine threatened to shoot me. I asked politely to quieten down the racket at 2:34 a.m. Yes, well, I don't think your neighbor loves you, but you're still supposed to love them, I think. Full armor of God is love, says Odin Wild Hunt. Lots of faith comments here. Guilt Elephant says, well done, Laura. Lovely to hear you, having seen you at Bridgen's speech. That's Andrew Bridgen's speech. Losing Liberty, Finding Freedom is indeed the title, as Grumpy Old Woman says. Well done, Laura. Lots of thumbs up there for Laura. And lots of thumbs up for my next guest, a stablemate here in today's News Talk TNT. The political editor himself will be Basil Valentine.
Basil. It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make American great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA. It's just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Basil Valentine, good afternoon to you. How are you doing today?
Yeah, very well, thank you, Lembit. Great to be with you. And hello to our viewers and listeners all around the world.
Two stories that you are supremely qualified to comment on. I noticed that a huge number of politicians are leaving the parliament. There's always a certain amount of churn, but it seems to be much higher this time. What do they go on to do and why are they leaving?
Oh, it's one of the oldest sayings in the book, Lembit, isn't it? Rats deserting a sinking ship. It seems to be mostly Conservative MPs. And they've already decided to walk into well-paid jobs. Surprise, surprise. A whole cohort of Conservative MPs are standing down before the next election and are walking into sinecures with various lobbying groups, ex-public companies, quangos of one sort or another, the revolving door, which is sort of not strictly speaking corruption. But the next best thing to it, this time includes 64 serving Tory MPs and four independent MPs who've lost the Conservative whip, all standing down. Well, in many cases with the 64 serving Tory MPs, they are no doubt afraid that they would lose their job or will lose their seats in the upcoming general election. And much better to grab your board positions while you've still got MP after your name, rather than after you face the returning officer with your vote having collapsed, as it doubtless will in September, October, because that's not such a good look when it comes to future employees.
Well, one thing I bitterly regret about the political situation that you describe is I didn't realize I was supposed to do that before I lost my seat.
What do you mean? You've got a great job here at TNT now, Lembit. You've got the best platform in the world from which you can speak freely. You couldn't ask for any more.
I was going to say we had Laura Brett, the evangelist, before. My redemption has indeed come, but I didn't spend 40 days in the wilderness. I spent 13 years there, 13 years. But anyway, it's all come good now, and it is a delight to be here in the home of our salvation, I think. You say it's like corruption, but what do the companies who explicitly employ these MPs expect to get from this? Influence? Well, very good. Wisdom?
Yes,
what?
I don't think it's much wisdom, my God. No, they expect to get influence. I mean, from my conversations with you, not that you've name-dropped deliberately, but it just so happens that inevitably after 10 years in Parliament, you know a lot of other MPs, and you've got their numbers in your phone, and you can give them a ring and have a chat about this and that. So while not necessarily being overtly, in inverted commas, corrupt, people like Brandon Lewis, the former Justice Secretary, interestingly, he's now taken on 5 part-time roles worth a total of £410,000 a year, alongside his commitments as an MP. The most lucrative of these is for Letter One Holdings, an international investment business, as well as FM Conway, an infrastructure and road building company that frequently works for national and local government. I would imagine that both FM Conway and Letter One Holdings will be hoping that Mr. Lewis picks up the phone and nudges one or two government departments, just has a quiet word in the shell, like, I'm not accusing him of that. I'm just saying they must get something for their money, Lembit.
I wish I had realized that it works like that when I was an MP. It's true. My phone's got lots of names in it, famous names, household names, but it never really occurred to me that it was monetizable. Obviously, I was behind the curve here, Basil.
Yes, well, you might be in that, you know, tiny number of MPs who are actually interested in representing their constituents, speaking up for them and trying to make the country a bit more agreeable and fairer. It seems, unfortunately, that the assorted hacks and apparatchiks currently populating the House of Commons are more interested in self-interest. Former Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng has registered, and this is while still an MP, jobs worth £98,600 a year. And Sajid Javid, aka Savage Jabba, he registered £321,000 a year, with Javid's case of £300,000 a year part-time advisory role to Jersey-based investment firm Centricus Partners. It's always these sort of rather opaque, vulture capitalist type organizations, not exactly household names, but often, hedge funds or takeover specialists, asset strippers of one sort or another, and £300,000 a year for a part-time job while still an MP. Well, what's that? That's £6,000 a week. I mean,
maybe you can help me, Basil. If you could send me a list of all of the vested interests that these politicians have, maybe I can give those companies a call myself. Or have I missed the boat?
Yes.
Don't answer that. Don't answer that. because rejection can often disappoint.
Oh, don't tell me about it.
The other subject I want to talk with you about briefly, because I'll be speaking with my next guest, Neil Petrie, about this, is the situation with Ukraine. The United States, after half a year of deliberation, has decided to send $61 million worth of military aid to Ukraine, and finally getting Zelensky to at least say, well, thanks very much. But if you look at the coverage, and this point has been actually made in the chat, I'm just looking down at it today, the message really is it's going to slow down the advance of Russia, but it doesn't suggest that the advance can be turned around. Number one, why did it take so long? Number two, have they made the right decision by sending $60 billion to Zelensky?
It's so long because of opposition from America First Republicans. And I mean, bizarrely, considering that the so-called Democratic Party was originally the anti-war party, not a single Democratic congressman voted against this package. Not one. Every single Democrat voted in favor of not just more money for Ukraine, but $28 billion more to continue the genocide in Gaza. And people on social media have been noticing that, you know, there's no money in America for public health care, for Sure Start programs, for schools, for public housing. You know, if you compare the streets of Philadelphia, for example, with these drug addict, homeless zombies, I feel sorry for them. So many broken lives. And even in the so-called middle class, people struggling to make ends meet, partly because of inflation, and inflation partly caused by the so-called Federal Reserve printing trillions of dollars of money, thereby devaluing the currency. You know, people are up in arms, frankly, because it seems that Congress doesn't act on behalf of the American people. Photos doing the rounds on X today of congressmen all waving Ukrainian flags as the vote goes through. You know, aren't they supposed to be representing their constituents in the United States? And the rhetoric coming out of idiots like Mike Johnson, who started talking about how Putin was going to invade the rest of Europe unless he was stopped in Ukraine, and that there's a biblical requirement to support Israel as well. I mean, really bizarro stuff. But what's actually happening is that Congress is funding the ethnic cleansing of Ukraine as well as Palestine, because all this means is that more Ukrainian young men and women and middle-aged men and anybody Zelensky can get hold of are going to be press ganged into the front line, where they're going to be blown to bits by the Russians in a totally unwinnable war. You know, it's time to sue for peace. This is all going in the wrong direction, Lembit.
So you and the Pope are of the same mind then, because the Pope has pretty much suggested the same thing. Others suggest that Biden should start a new group now called MUGA, Make Ukraine Great Again, but he hasn't got a chance of doing it because the supply chain for Putin is the width of a border. The supply chain for America is the width of a transatlantic ocean. And I wonder if, when inevitably Putin carries on and Zelensky carries on and Zelensky goes back cap in hand in about 4 months for another $61 billion, he'll get it.
Well, let's hope not. And we don't know how much of that $61 billion is actually going to go into the war chest, and how much of it is going to end up in the pockets of Ukrainian officials who've been buying themselves lavish properties all around the world, quite apart from Zelensky's cocaine dealer. I saw a hilarious post on X with pastiching Zelensky and Al Pacino's character from that famous film, whose name escapes me for a moment. We don't know for certain whether Zelensky is still a cocaine addict, but there's also a lot footage of him brushing his nose. Yeah, I mean, this is the word on the street, as it were. Don't sue me. It's only alleged. But yeah, it's a big money laundering operation, apart from anything else. $95 billion in total is being sent abroad. That could do all sorts of things in the United States, Lembit. You know, help countless thousands of people.
I can't remember. Oh, well, there was a film called Heat in which he was a crook. Are you saying Zelensky basically is a sharp player in all of this? Or a great war leader?
I mean, I find it hard to take him seriously. You know, there's only a few years ago he was humiliating himself as a sort of extreme visual comedian, playing the piano with his penis and dancing in lycra bodysuits on television. And now he stands at the epicenter of what is potentially World War III. I find it extraordinary. Equally extraordinary, believe it or not, CNN ran a headline saying Mike Johnson could be the American Churchill. Lembit, we're living in some sort of bizarro clown world these days. Scarface. Maybe. That's the Pacino movie. Scarface.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, scarred. Scarred politics, I think we've got there. Basil, thanks for interrupting your Sunday to give us your perspective. When are you next back on today's news talk? When can we see you again?
You can see me again at 11:40 a.m. British summertime tomorrow morning with Rick Munn.
I think of little else. Thank you very much indeed. And we're going to continue on that theme with Neil Petrie, who is a former Army intelligence officer, 16 years experience. And we'll start with the question of what's actually going on in Israel. Will the $28 million, which Basil has just highlighted, is being sent there, do more good than harm or more harm than good? Do keep your calls and comments coming. I shall read them as well just before we go to Neil. All of that with me, Lemba Topic, here on today's News Talk. I'll see you in a minute.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to today's News Talk TNT with me, Lemba Topic. In a moment, I'll be speaking with Neil Petrie. Let me read some of the comments, though, caused and provoked by Basil Valentine, our political editor. Basil for Prime Minister, says Madrid. Please, Dembit, and all good, honest people, you now know how to set up a political party. I've sort of done that before. I don't think I want to do it again. Wee Fat Chuck says, LOL, no such thing as that, Basil. It would be easier to find the Loch Ness Monster. Well, I saw a documentary. Going to Neil Gardner, Sure Start was always about phasing out natural families, i.e. encouraging all alternative household units. Madrid says, Putin is welcome in my home. I'll pass that on. Wee Fat Chuck, that Zelensky is just a masthead puppet. Hidden Truth says, Lembit, Zelensky is a CIA stooge and puppet and an MI6 asset. Please look at Agent Zelensky by a Ukrainian documentary maker. And just one more. Mazzy says, Israel's wartime public diplomacy star auditions for Dancing with the Stars. Alon Levy, a spokesman for the National Public Diplomacy Directorate, who gained recognition through his international media interviews, auditions for a reality show amid war. No decision made yet in his participation. Mazzy, I'm not sure if you're joking or not. Not on that, but I've read it out there. So either it's said in jest or it's for real. Either way, it's pretty good. Pretty amazing news. Neil Petrie, I don't think you're planning to audition for reality TV. You've done some rather more important things in your life. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm definitely not trying for reality TV.
the money's good. Don't say no before you hear the figures. And also, I think you'd have no trouble in the jungle at all. You were an Army intelligence officer 16 years. Tell us a little bit about that, and also your involvement with the UK Direct Democracy movement.
Yeah, I was in the military joining in 81. So I went to Sandhurst and then came out and went straight into the intelligence school. And obviously did a few jobs in there for 16 years, a variety. So I had good training and good times, a lot of good people I obviously worked with, and some interesting places around the world, Hong Kong, America, and obviously a few other spots. And then after that, or during that time, actually, I heard about the Swiss democracy. And obviously in the military, you don't get involved in all of the political side of things, but that sparked my interest in direct democracy, which is what I do now with a group of people looking at, you know, setting up a direct democracy in the UK, or more of a system similar to the Swiss one, really. So that's what we're trying to do, and there's a good movement with Neil Oliver's group that we work with. Nigel Farage is a supporter of the direct democracy, as is Andrew Bridgen. So there's it's getting some momentum now, and we're doing that. Sorry.
How does that? Yeah, so, finish your point, then I'll ask you a question. Sorry, I talked over you twice.
Basically, we're getting all of these different people together, trying to get Trump to take on some interest as well, because they can do advisory referendums in the States as well, but they're only advisory, you know, under their constitution.
How does the model that you're promoting work? What does direct democracy want to see implemented in Britain?
Well, we're a movement, we're not a party. So all we're trying to do is encourage people to understand. It's really to inform, to reform, so that people become aware that on top of the representatives, basically, you have the direct democracy, tools of direct democracy. So you can use referendums on every law coming out of Parliament. Now, it doesn't mean you get a referendum on everyone, but if you get enough support, for instance, they get 1% of the voters in Switzerland signing up to petition for a referendum, then you can have a first past the post referendum. So that's the defensive way. So you stop the politicians cranking out rubbish, and that's the main defense.
So you could, for example, have a referendum in the United Kingdom to simply say, do you support, do you want to see the scrapping of the net zero targets, yes or no?
Yeah, these are the types of things. If it's a law and there's a law saying all of these different things, then you could do that. Or you could also start an initiative, they call it in Switzerland. So there's two things. There's the offensive one, which is the initiative, which means that you can create your own law, Lembit, and whatever it was you wanted to cover. And but you have to get 2% of the voters signing up. You know, it's about 100,000 in Switzerland. But that's it. If you get 2% signing up, you will then would be about a million here. Be about almost exactly a million you need to get signed up. But then you could introduce that as an idea. You get the 2%, you get the first past the post referendum on that basis. And then if you win, you'll get your law in place. Only about 15% of those types of things go through in Switzerland, but they do go through.
That's quite interesting, Neil. I was one of maybe 2 million people who marched through London in opposition to what was, I regard as the illegal war in Iraq. Government just ignored it. It sounds to me that, yeah, it sounds to me that if we actually had a referendum on that, it's hard to work out foreign policy like that. But if we had a referendum, the majority would have been opposed by then, and had been justified in being opposed. Just in terms of the resistance you'll get, having been in Parliament, Parliament will do anything to not give away power. It wants to make it look like it's giving away power, but it gives it to its mates, which is why the Bank of England can set the interest rate, which I think is a terrible mistake in itself. Have you got to the stage where Parliament has started providing active resistance to your proposal?
Not that we've seen yet, not directly, because we're very new to this game, really, and very small. However, we're gaining momentum quickly, so that we're expecting, obviously, that opposition. That will definitely arise. And, Andrew Bridgen, as I say, is already supporting it. So there's an MP in Parliament who's backing direct democracy. And, he came to our meeting in Sheffield on the 2nd of April, and he spoke there. So it's underway, it's starting, and you know, we've got independents who are standing for direct democracy. They'll be standing at the next election. There's quite a few people who are in reform who'd like to stand on the basis of direct democracy as well, which Nigel backs. But I think within the party, from Tice and a few others up there, you know, there's no support, I don't think. So I'm just trying to persuade them, look, you know, whoever goes for this is going to get a lot of support. Because, you know, whenever we talk to people about it, you know, they can go to our website, ddrightnow.com, and on there is our proposal. It's a one-page downloadable PDF document, and it lays out exactly the process we're recommending. But as I say, we're not a party, we're a movement, and encouraging people to adopt that. But there are people who are, you know, one MP already, as it were, and they're lining up now. So that's the plan.
Give me a call. I think I'm quite interested in this myself. Not because I want to settle any scores. It's actually because I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Well, I'm glad to hear that. That a lot of people find it very, you know, they convert very quickly, to be honest.
Do you know the referendum I'd want to have, Neil? It would be about drugs policy. I would want to legalize and regulate all drugs because... Well, yeah.
The Swiss have sensible drugs laws. You know, and they really try to help people get off them, but they're not so criminally dealt with, you know, so they're more decent in that. But that's what you could suggest. You could look at something like that and see where someone's doing it, where it's working, you know, and helping them through that process so that, you know, they don't get like, look at America with fentanyl and all the rest of it. You know, I mean, is it 500,000 have died on that stuff?
Yeah. No, I've never met a single person in my entire life who said, well, I was a drug addict, but then the government made it illegal, so I stopped. Not one person in my whole life. I'd rather tax the addict and then use the tax to fix the situation, or at least to manage the situation. But that's for another time. Fascinating. Yeah. I'm seriously interested in talking with you more about this. Thank you for doing something which would actually increase the accountability of our parliament, which is in a terrible parlous state at the moment. What I want to ask you about is one of the decisions that is being made in America at the moment and implicitly supported by the UK, as far as I can see, which is this endless pouring of money into the money pit of Ukraine. I don't know, maybe you think it's a good idea. $61,000 million passed now yesterday for more support for Zelensky. You're much more qualified than me to make a judgment on this from a military perspective. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I was out of the army in 97, so I'm obviously not up to date. But what I have learned since then, because I'm out of the military, I don't have that same way of thinking as when I was in. So I've studied more widely and looked into all of the issues, you know, with regards to the military-industrial complex. And I had 2 years in the American army as an exchange officer. So I've seen it from the inside there. And, you know, when you look at what the expenditure that they put into their military system, it's phenomenal. And, of course, all that money that's now going to go out to Ukraine, if you listen to Robert F. Kennedy talking about it, he explains that it comes back almost immediately into the American coffers. So it's lent out, and then it goes into the military-industrial complex, Lockheed and all the rest of them. So this 60-odd billion, in fact, it's just the American taxpayers being, you know, conned into putting all this money into the Ukraine. And, you know, because ultimately, if you read my book, actually, One Vote Away, Saving the West, I cover a lot of these issues because, unfortunately, it's the Ukrainians are just a sacrificial lamb on the part of the Americans, obviously trying to take over the resources globally, which has always been their strategy since World War II in particular, when they set out what they called the Grand Area, which were those parts of the world that they wanted to have their hands on or control over. And so the CIA developed all of that, you know, during the 50s to ensure that they got the influence where they needed in Africa and Asia. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, then the whole thing went pretty much global. So it's a very complex picture. It involves obviously Russia and China against the United States. The United States being undermined by China with fentanyl and all the other means that they use to undermine, you know, the morale of the country and its economy. So it does get very complicated. And in Ukraine, obviously, they poured the money in, but it's come straight back. So it's actually being paid into the coffers of the people who support those politicians to get re-elected. So
will it make a military difference, Neil? The reason I asked this, I can see the appeal of the dynamic here, which I hadn't considered before now, I have to admit, even though it's obvious when you say it. The idea is you spend $61 billion, most of which goes into production in America. All of it gets blown, basically exploded. The $61 billion gets blown up in Ukraine, and then you can do it again.
But, yeah, exactly. So when you think about it, well, they lost in Afghanistan and almost immediately rotated into Ukraine. So they left $80 billion worth of equipment there. So Afghanistan was left with all of this kit that had been paid for by the American taxpayer again. A few thousand American dead, you know, on the ground there. But, you know, for the people who are in charge of the industries, there's no cost to them. You know, it's all profit margins.
Did the American Treasury ever tax the Afghan army for benefit in kind?
Yeah. Well, they certainly taxed the American people enough.
They certainly did. And now we've got this military situation. So you've explained an interesting economic dynamic, which in a way is quite smart. It's the old idea of digging holes and filling them in again, and creating, well, a Keynesian environment, I suppose, really, in terms of creating work. Can it make a military difference, in your opinion, in Ukraine?
It may hold them a bit longer. You know, you've got to think as well, if it's really highly technical, then obviously who are the guys who are going to run it? You can bring some people back to America to get trained up. But some of these systems, you know, they require a lot of experienced operators. And they might have a few in Ukraine, but not in the same numbers as the Americans. The Americans have got, you know, 300 million people. Ukraine's about 40 odd million, isn't it? And so it's a battle of attrition. You know, the Russians have got a lot more people and the Ukrainians have got a lot less now. So if they're dying in proportion or similar proportions, then obviously the Ukraine's weakening faster. And but with the fancy kit that they all need, that they will allow to be used there as well. Because obviously, if you've got very high tech stuff, do you want to put it on the battlefield before and expose your capabilities to the enemy when you want to come in with your own equipment as a NATO power? And you're going to give it to a non-NATO power to use? There are restrictions, obviously, on what they can be given. So the equipment won't be as good as it could be. So, yeah, I don't think actually it's going to make a massive difference. And, yeah, you know, it's a tragedy. Again, this is another tragedy because, again, you know, these things, that there were opportunities earlier for a negotiated settlement, which Putin was happy to go with. But, you know, Boris was flown out, apparently, to go out and tell Zelensky, no, you're going to have to carry on. So if you watch Rob F. Kennedy on some of the YouTube videos, he's very good on this stuff. And he's very clear about what's been happening. And in fact, you know, the Ukrainians apparently are already having to pay off a lot of the debt by handing over their land to Monsanto and other great agricultural combines in America. So, you know, it's the richest, you know, earth on the in the world, apparently. You know, it's a very, it's the breadbasket of Europe and Africa and all the rest of the world. Massive, you know, grain harvest every year. And that is now being, you know, handed over to the Americans. So there's a lot of blood being spilled, you know, to the last Ukrainian, the Americans will fight, basically. That's where we're heading towards, I'm afraid. So I'm a bit more cynical than I was when I was in. You know, I left, as I say, nearly 30 years ago now. And I do not see the world in the same way as I did when I was actually in intelligence.
It's clear now that the military-industrial complex has a lot to gain from the incineration of their products and the backfilling. I can see that.
Yeah.
I can see that Zelensky himself has much to gain. If you deal with these huge sums of money, there's got to be some appeal there. I can see why it's good for him. But is this sustainable when we all now know that Russian military production is orders of magnitude greater than anything that Ukraine can get access to?
Yeah, well, again, you see, Putin is—he's on to about 40% apparently of his, you know, of his economy is being driven, you know, or the GDP is going into this military-industrial complex, which is similar to what the Soviets had at points, you know, in time. So yeah, he can only do that for so long, obviously. But you know, if he's using that, the Americans might be thinking, well, we're straining him already just on the Ukraine, and they haven't had to go and, you know, get involved at all, and just the threat of it. So there's always a strategy, Lempit. You know how it works. Yeah, at these levels, well above us, you know, there are people sitting there in darkened rooms in their little huddles and coming up with plans for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, etc., and how they fit into the longer term plan, which is 100 years.
I'll come back to you in just a moment. We're talking with Neil Petrie. I want to ask him why Russia's economy is growing faster and predictably growing faster than any other leading country in the world. I would suspect that China might perform, but we'll see. And also, I want to talk a little bit about the situation in Israel as well. You're watching the Lembotopic Show here on Today's News Talk TNT. I'll see you in a moment.
The challenges our planet's animals are facing sometimes feel a bit heavy.
Animals haven't eaten in a day, 2 days, they haven't drank anything, they're cold, they're dehydrated.
As soon as we started our descent, everywhere I could see was mud, just absolutely mud.
So the country has been in prolonged drought so long, it was like a tinderbox waiting to go up.
Okay, very heavy. Each of us wants to be part of the solution, and we can be. Remember that there's good happening right now. At home.
All right, we were able to get into your unit and we have all four of your cats. So,
okay.
And around the world. For any animal in any disaster. So let's focus on that, right? Be part of the solution, one rescue at a time. Search ifa.org/disaster ready.
I want to eat apples and bananas. I need to eat apples and bananas. Why can't I eat apples and bananas?
Support the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks to help provide meals to those in need. Join us at feedingamerica.org.
This is the Lembotopic Show on Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the last quarter of an hour of the show. Where does the time go? You're with Lembotopic here on Today's News Talk, TNT. I'm still with Neil Petrie, who is a military expert and also author of the book One Vote Away. We'll be asking him a little bit more about that book and talking about briefly about Ukraine and a little bit more extensively about the Middle East. Before we go into that, Mr. Ted wants me to ask you about the Julian Assange situation. What's your take about Julian Assange? To save time, my view is his crime is to reveal other people's whistleblowing, but apparently that's a crime now.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a journalist, isn't he? So he's obviously damaged some people in America, you know, as far as they're concerned, and they have long reach, you know, and we're the 51st state of America in many ways anyway, and, you know, that is the truth of it, unfortunately, you know, when you look at how things are handled. And so we're just being the he's a patsy, isn't he, really? And as you say, he's a journalist. He's given out what would be seen as sensitive by some people, but it's mainly because it's political rather than military. These are not military secrets that he's been revealing, but conversations by very senior officials that are embarrassed by what's gone on. And, you know, the performance and the way some of these units have operated, you know, in various conflicts.
Before we go on to the next subject, which is your book, let me just read a few comments. I said I would have a referendum on legalizing and regulating all drugs. This has caused something of a reaction, Neil. A different Neil, Neil Gardner, says, the way things are going, psychoactive drugs will soon be mandatory, unless you pass your regular mental health assessment, of course. And yeah. Neil adds, just to check you're not suffering from critical thinking syndrome. And one more... where Neil goes on about groupthink. And the question just about your book is, what are we one vote away from?
Right. Basically, Lord Sumption said that with the 2010 Parliamentary Act, you only need one vote to change the Constitution. So, you know, our aim is obviously to see a change so that we become a Swiss-style direct democracy where the people have supreme power. That's the reality. We have to have that, you know, supreme position in terms of the authority over the laws that are coming out and also the opportunity to, you know, introduce our own. and that's it, then you've got that, and it's one vote away. It's not just about that, because I talk through a lot of those things we've been talking about here, about critical thinking. It's an intelligence officer trying to explain, you know, how to look at things as possibilities, probabilities. Sometimes it's quite grey, the areas that you talk about in intelligence and in life in general, but also how you can then build up a way of analysing what's gone on, but looking at the real world and showing that a lot of these, what they call conspiracy theories, are in fact real strategies. I take people through from, I say you can go from being a conspiracy theorist to a strategy analyst. So that's what I'm trying to help people with. So you read the book and you'll learn a great deal about, you know, the history of where a lot of these conspiracies arise from. And in fact, they're quite real in a good number of cases. And tragically, of course, you know, as Churchill said, there's no such thing as public opinion. There's only published opinion. You see, so that's the reality, is that who controls the font, you know, of our knowledge, you know, the schools, the press, the universities. And of course, you know, you get radicals who understand that. So the universities in America were taken over really largely by a lot of former Maoists, people who are in groups like the Weather Underground, and they became the great professors of teaching. So they then taught the teachers, who then become the ones who obviously feed into the system the thinking of these people. So it's, you know, you've got to think very long term, and you've got to study the communists, to be quite frank, to see what's going on. And then you look at the who they're against. But you also look at the Carnegie and Rockefellers set up education foundations, the General Education Foundation, I think it was, which was in fact, you know, a Rockefeller outfit. But that becomes the department that sets up what is decided to be the American public school system and how it should function. So the whole of our history is really about the control by different groups, different elites on the left and the right. They're battling it out still now. And, you know, you see in China, they'll use any techniques. They supply the fentanyl that goes into America. They've got their, you know, spies, you know, what was it, Senator Swalwell or whatever his name was sleeping with a Chinese spy, and all of these types of things where they're, oh, yeah, these are all real events, so you can just look them up. And so, and you know, the guy in the Atomic Research Center, Chinese scientist there, American, but, you know, they keep tabs on who's Chinese and living abroad and has links back into, obviously, the homeland. And even then, even if they don't, they might still try it on just because it's, you know, they see them as being an easy touch.
You mentioned going underground. I thought you were going to burst into a Jam song, which has the line, yeah, the public gets
one of my
the
favorites.
Wants. And the yeah, public wants true. What the public gets. It's in my head now, and probably there'll be quite a few people in Britain will be humming that this afternoon.
That's a theme tune for us.
It could be, actually. It's a great song, actually. It's an angry song. Hemingway says, this is in terms of your direct democracy movement, says police commissioner elections are on May the 2nd, some on three-figure salaries. I think you mean six-figure salaries, Hemingway.
Yeah.
Simply highlight another unnecessary level of bureaucracy on top of another to make us think that we're a democracy when we're nothing of the sort. They were introduced in 2010 under the Tory Lib Dem coalition. So much bad came out of that. And crime hasn't exactly gone down since then. So they're clearly working not. Good point, actually. I do think we've got endless categories of bureaucracy. The Welsh Assembly, in its infinite wisdom, introduced a blanket 20-mile-an-hour speed limit across urban areas of Wales, costing millions of hours of time of drivers. Now they're partially repealing it. I could have told them it was a stupid idea to begin with. I have to say, my advice is to people, do not invest in Wales, because you're going to spend your time driving around at 20 miles an hour. It's an absolute nightmare, and woe betide anybody who thinks that they should be investing in anything to do with road transport until they sort that out. But that's my hobby horse. That's my own little annoyance. In terms of the other situation, Neil, we see, as well as $61,000 million going into Ukraine, another $28 billion going into Israel. Now, at the outset, I'll say one thing that really bugs me with this, and I've said it many times, is that to criticize Israel gets you the label of being an anti-Semite. There is nothing about criticizing Israeli policy that makes you an anti-Semite de facto. It can just, it's as stupid as saying, well, I disagreed with Tony Blair about the Iraq war, therefore I must be anti-Catholic. It's ridiculous. So leaving that aside, Netanyahu, who's clearly a hawk, clearly wants to carry on, clearly talks openly and with no shame about killing every Hamas operative, whatever happened to due process there, is getting another $28 billion from America. What's your take on that?
Well, it's like any war, you know, people always talk about wiping out and all the rest of it, and it doesn't work that way. You know, you end up with more opponents, you know, people get recruited from abroad even, people come home. So you don't kill them all until, you know, you're, you've spent every single last one of your lives as well. It's not going to happen. No, it always comes to an agreement, you know. And the aim of any war should be a better peace, shouldn't it? But what is the better peace for Israel is obviously, it looks like it's one of the eradication of Gaza, isn't it? You know, driving the people out and seeing that, the, you know, that, that becomes a emptied. So I think the Israelis have, I heard the defense minister straight after the October 7th, you know, atrocities, but I did hear him referring to these people as human animals. And I thought, oh, that's a bit Rwanda-like, you know, and that is genocidal talk, you know, to a lot of people. So you're dehumanizing when they're human animals. Now, yeah, it was terrible what's going on, obviously, but then when you start talking like that, you're letting loose, you know, kind of emotions that should be let loose, really. You know, and he's a defense minister and a military guy, because obviously you don't do that. He shouldn't have done that. And it's reflected in the behavior, obviously.
The thing that bothers me is my life experience growing up in Northern Ireland and then being centrally involved in the peace process. I was Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland for a decade. And we all know, well, anybody who studies it knows that an event called Bloody Sunday, which happened 40 years ago now, 50 years ago, actually, when British troops killed peace protesters, actually, in a place called Derry or Londonderry. That caused them to recruit more people to the terrorist organization known as the IRA. In other words, the military intervention was actually a recruiting sergeant for the terrorist groups. Now, I don't think that human nature is very different in Gaza or anywhere else in the world. It seems to me, Neil, that what we're doing, what we're observing Benjamin Netanyahu doing, isn't eradicating Hamas, but probably causing a backfill. If your brother gets killed by the Israeli Defense Force, you might join Hamas. You're more likely to, because you've now got less to lose.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a rock and a hard place, this, isn't it? Because obviously we're seeing the effects here in the West, obviously, with these marches and all of these things that are going on. And there was a murder up in Hartlepool, I think it was, not long ago, where I think it was Moroccan, he murdered an old-age pensioner because he was angry about what was going on in Palestine, and he tried to kill, I think, an apostate who had left Islam. And so he didn't like that, because under their law you can't do this. So he went to try and kill the apostate, and then he ends up failing in that, and he goes out and he kills an old-age pensioner here in the UK. So there are direct effects here from the overspill. And then, as you say, if you look in Israel itself, then you've got the issue that you've got two groups. The animosity is you know, too deep to be healed, really, I think. And it goes back a lot longer than just, you know, Israel's establishment. You had the Jews living under the Muslims, you know, for centuries as second-class citizens. So there is that issue that the history, I don't see it being resolvable, quite frankly.
In which case, this $28 million simply extends the carnage without bringing us any closer to a resolution.
Well, you know, the two-state thing, I think the Israelis have given up on. That is the reality I can see in the strategy that they're evolving, and we see evolving in front of us, and they wish to see the removal of, you know, Hamas from Gaza and Gaza itself cleared. So it's an unusual place, Gaza, as well, isn't it, as well, because it was Egyptian, was it not? There are all of these issues over its, you know, its existence in the first place. But I don't see how you resolve it, you know, without the Israelis accepting that there should be some form of a second state agreement. However, the Arabs don't want a two-state agreement either. So the West continues pouring money in, and I don't see how we're going to resolve it, quite frankly. I just don't see it.
If you add all that together, the situation in Ukraine, the situation in Gaza, are we really, and the interaction between Israel and Iran, which to my relief at least seems to have de-escalated, seems to, I don't attempt fate. Are we living in a more unstable world, or actually is this window dressing, and actually the underlying cabal of leaders don't have any real intention of kicking off World War III, but they do have an intention of keeping us afraid?
Yeah, that's a large part of it. And I think the other thing is, you know, Trump. If Trump gets back in, you'll see a change again. You know, Trump, for all what people might see as his faults, you know, he got us the Abraham Accords. Okay. I remember walking around a shopping center in Dubai and these Jewish people walked past. And I thought, I knew this had been going on, the negotiations had been going on, but then there they were. There was proof of it that, you know, this had happened and these people were now flying in and, you know, visiting Dubai. So I think, you know, when you look at the future, it's Trump is what's looming over the heads of these people, because they see him as a guy who wants peace, you see, and they understand that he won't pay out for this war machine forever. He's told the NATO that they have to come to. And in fact, NATO have said that Trump forced the Europeans to start paying more. And, you know, it was good for NATO as far as NATO is concerned. But I'm not so sure about NATO's role, you know, and it's not what it was. Why is it still doing what it's doing? It's because we're actually, it's a driver of American policy. That's what it's about. That's what it's really about. It's not about defense of the West. It's about the continued encroachment as they move forward across the East towards Russia to put the Russians under pressure, because eventually they wanted regime change, you know, and the CIA were the ones who were involved in the, you know, the original revolution back in 2014. They put billions into that. You know, and this was a deliberate act by the CIA, and I think it was the State Department lady Nuland, Victoria Nuland, who's just resigned, and she was heavily involved in that. And there are many tapes of her talking about this. So there's wheels within wheels, I'm afraid. You know, that's how life is.
And the winner will be China, in my opinion.
That's right. Well, I know someone who was saying that they had used to get payments out of Russia. And they were paying them through China. That was how they're getting their money out. It had to go through China. And the Chinese have stopped that, apparently. So in other words, you know, they're tightening up on their support for Russia, or, you know, because don't forget, large parts of the Far East were Chinese and the Russians took them. Yeah. 19th century, I think it was.
Yeah. On a completely trivial note, did you know that today's National Big Word Day, Neil? Hemingway's telling me this. Yeah.
Oh,
Hemingway's hoping I have a big, have a good one so far. Do you have a favourite big word that can be repeated?
Yeah. No, to be honest, I'm like Orwell. Keep it simple, you know. I believe in simpler words that are understandable. So I don't go around thinking about long words too much. I think it make me try to sound like an intellectual. I'm not trying to be an intellectual. I don't consider that a pat on the back.
That's very anti-disestablishmentarianistic of you, Neil.
Oh, there you go.
Expialidocious. Real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you. That's Neil Petrie. And that brings me to the end of my time with you. Big thank you to Neil and everyone else who attended. Big thank you to Charlotte, my producer, and Alistair in the gallery. And the biggest thank you to you for watching. I hope you found this interesting, edifying, provocative, and informative, and has helped your opinions. I'll be back next weekend, and who knows, during the week as well. Do stay with TNT. This is the home of free speech. It's my pleasure to serve you as best I can. Do keep thinking, asking, and developing your own opinions. This is today's News Talk. I'm Len Bitopek. Have a wonderful day.